Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to continue with the discussion on the internal workings of the Stalinist era Soviet Communist Party. Previously we talked about membership, we talked about the fact that one had to really be able to digest and understand very complex and esoteric ideas such as the Marxist-Leninist dialectic of history, dialectical materialism, and the various precepts of Marxist thinking and economics, in order to be considered the right kind of Homo Sovieticus that would be eligible to join the party. Now we're going to look at internal party debate and the lack thereof. The membership changed in the 1930s. There was an attempt to create a fully proletarian party, one which up to that point hadn't exactly existed. It had been a revolution. The Bolshevik Party originally had been a party of the revolutionary intelligentsia. There had been working class members, Stalin being one of them. But Stalin was this kind of curious hybrid between a working class Georgian and part of the revolutionary intelligentsia himself. His early years, after he'd been kicked out of seminary, were not spent working in factories. They were spent as a revolutionary agitator and somebody in charge of printing revolutionary newspapers. So he has lots of working class credentials, but not so far as he was a proper working proletarian for much of his life. The changes in membership take place mainly in the 1930s, and at the start of the Stalin era, the ideal was that there should be a proletarian party. This meant that proletarians, factory workers, and other heavy industry workers were encouraged to join in large numbers, and the white collars, the white collar professions of Russia, such as they were, professionals, engineers, people with skills, those would have been office workers, that kind of thing, were discouraged from joining the party. The large enrolment of workers and peasants during the first five-year plan meant that the party grows immensely. But this isn't always a good thing, because you bring in an awful lot of people to the party who are simply careerists, who don't really understand the ideology, who don't get what Soviet communism actually is, and they see the party as a good opportunity for advancement. Now, Marxist-Leninists at the time within the party argued that it's these sort of opportunist types who really haven't got a revolutionary bone in their body. They're going to kill the party. They're actually going to kill socialism in Russia. And eventually you'll wind up with a kind of rather toxic managerial bureaucracy and a return to bourgeois values. So in 1933, admissions are suspended. And then there are party purges to clean out the party and to get rid of those who are not sufficiently committed to Soviet communism or Marxist-Leninism. Again, the same thing happens during the Great Purges, which are obviously a far more brutal and violent way of removing dead wood from the party. And in both these instances, there are dramatic promotions for young party members who find themselves in jobs which are far beyond their level of experience. And they are quite literally sitting in dead men's shoes. Enemies of the people have been removed from these roles significantly earlier. The admissions to the party that happen after the purges don't have the same kind of proletarian emphasis. Now we're drifting towards the threat of war. Stalin at this point is obsessed with the threat of Hitler. He is well aware of the damage he's done to the country's infrastructure, to its bureaucracy, and most significantly to its military preparedness. And the quest to get meritocratic values, to get the skilled workers into and administrators into key jobs, is the highest imperative. And so the white-collar professionals and managerial professionals who had been barred from entry previously to the party wind up being able to access it in the later part of the 1930s. The Stalin era saw the end of what internal party debate there actually was. The 1930s sees the end of any factionalism and any internal debate within the Communist Party. The leaders of the left opposition, who had attracted the ire of Lenin before he died, were expelled from the party by 1927. The right opposition of 1928 to 29. Was sufficiently aware of the fate of the left that it didn't really waste any of its energies organising itself at all. Instead, it seeks to minimise damage and avoid the threat of factionalism and then the punishment of expulsion from the party. There were a number of smaller and almost kind of inconsequential underground opposition groups that did little more than talk. And they were easily infiltrated by the secret police, the OGPU, arrested and sent to an unpleasant fate in the camps, or some indeed simply executed. The ability to carry out debate within the party was limited. The party had been a kind of a little constellation of groupings and intellectual huddles during the mid-1920s. There had been academic centres of thinking within the party, the Institute of Red Professors being a particularly renowned one. And this is where Marxism was debated. I mean, the thing about Marxism or Marxist-Leninism is that in both instances, these are theoretical models of explaining history, society and economics. And the application of Marxist-Leninism is a process that generates endless debates. Are we doing it right? Are things happening as Marx suggested they would do? These kinds of discussions. And so you can imagine that the party was rich with discussion, debate and internal conversation. Until, of course, the advent of Stalinism, where the ultimate arbiter of Marxist-Leninism in the ultimate kind of interpreter of Lenin's tradition was Stalin himself. And Stalin shuts down any serious discussion of Marxist-Leninism for the rest of his lifetime until 1953. And even after that, it can't be said to have seriously reinstated itself. There were figures such as Bukharin, who attracted the kind of the ire of Stalin by having his own, not necessarily personality cult, but certainly personal following. As did, of course, Leon Trotsky. But in both instances, neither Bukharin nor Trotsky was able to attract really the significant following of support that Stalin could. And one of the reasons is that Stalin, as general secretary of the party, had power of appointment and power of patronage across the party, and he had been able to offer fairly simple and what appeared to be practical solutions to a country that saw itself at siege, and the idea of socialism in one country was very appealing at that point, far more practical than Trotsky's ideas of continuous revolution. But also Stalin was able to put bread on the table for a lot of people within the party by appointing them two party roles. Of course, he had to kind of get rid of a large number of others, but that was fairly easy to do when you have a large network of camps for people that complain. The era of political debate and engagement in political debate by the rest of the party also came to an end. It becomes much too dangerous during the Stalin era to spend one's time thinking about what different factions of the party are discussing. There is, after 1928, only one faction of the party that matters, that is Stalin and his inner circle, and discussing and debating what Stalin has to say, once again, is unwise, as one might appear to be critical. So the anti-democratic force that Stalin comes to be during this period of time operates in various different ways, forcing opposition from the party, forcing debate out of the party, and ending really engagement between the party hierarchy and the grassroots. The grassroots know better than to get involved in politics at all. The language of the party in the 1930s is very reminiscent of the Civil War era. It's very machismo-istic, if that's actually a word, a very aggressive. The language of the party is about struggle, fighting, the struggle to build socialism, the war against class enemies. These kinds of things are constantly being said. Stalin's own uniform is a kind of like a sorry, paramilitary look of a tunic and boots and trousers tucked into them, and it's not the sort of definitive bourgeois look of a Western politician. It's semi-militaristic. Party members often were armed. It was not uncommon for party members attending congresses to come with the gun that perhaps they'd wielded during the Civil War.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Normally a pistol of some description. The problem that Stalin saw was that the Soviet Union needed to have a figure like him, and it needed a dictatorship. It needed not just a dictatorship, but a particularly ideologically charged and ideologically purposed dictatorship in order to keep the revolutionary state within it, safe from the predations of the outside world. The Bolsheviks were obsessed with the French Revolution and the Thermidorian counter-revolution. They were obsessed with the Paris Commune, and they were certain that if they were not very careful, the same thing would happen in Russia, that the revolution would be overturned either by outside or by internal interference. Stalin's role as dictator, but also public intellectual, whereby he frequently made had interviews with the Soviet press and often with Western journalists, fellow traveller journalists, who made it to the Soviet Union to interview him, quite famously once H.G. Wells. And Walter Duranty, who was fairly kind of corrupted by Stalinism and loathed by the rest of the press corps. These kinds of moments were used by Stalin to present himself as a kind of an explainer of world affairs. When you read these interviews, he comes across as this sort of almost detached observer, but he's certainly anything but. He was a figure who tried to install in the Soviet population a fear and mistrust of capitalist powers. Probably this was well placed, given the Russian Civil War and the views that most capitalist nations had towards the Soviet Union. But also he tried to instill a certain kind of, not xenophobia, because it's certainly not racial, but a certain hostility towards Western powers, who were seen as exploiters and bullies, and those who would do the Soviet Union down if they got a chance. And the thinking, the popular thinking about external enemies, was that they wouldn't be given that chance, that the society that Stalin had created would be eternally vigilant. This is a kind of a contributory factor to the terror. It creates the kind of the culture of terror, but anything could be explained that was not working or going wrong within the building of communism bit by bit, the process of socialist construction. Anything that went wrong could be explained on saboteurs, on enemies external to the Soviet Union looking to destroy the country. Stalin, however, did like to think of himself as a statesman. He did like to think about great power relations in quite a traditional way, of seeing the interaction between states as being much more important than the promulgation of revolution. By the mid-1930s, he's really put this one onto a back burner. The only thing, for example, that Comintern is useful for is after 1933 and the advent of Hitler. Comintern is useful for trying to build progressive alliances between socialists and communists. This is something that probably should have been done before 1933, but Stalin actually actively undermined that, as we know, and popular fronts. And obviously Comintern has a strong role to play in Spain, and I've done innumerable podcasts on that one. But actually creating overseas revolutions in other first world countries was not really on Stalin's wish list, which is ironic considering that the children of 1917, the generation that grew up after that, saw this as a dream that was central to their thinking of worldwide revolution. In Everyday Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick, she cites Lev Kopolev and his memoir, in which he says, "The world revolution was absolutely necessary so that justice would triumph. All those incarcerated in bourgeois prisons would be set free. Those starving in India and China would be fed. The lands taken from the Germans and the Danzig corridor would be returned, and our Bessarabia would be taken back from Romania. But also so that afterwards there would be no borders, no capitalists and no fascists at all. And so that Moscow, Kharkov, Kiev and Kiev would become just as enormous, just as well built as Berlin, Hamburg and New York. So that we would have skyscrapers, streets full of automobiles and bicycles. So that all the workers and peasants would go walking in fine clothes, wearing hats and watches. So that airplanes and dirigibles would go flying everywhere." And such, and this was essentially a view of modernity, a socialist modernity. And in the eyes of many of the revolutionaries of 1917, modernity could only really be achieved by the sweeping away of capitalism. To them, capitalism was about slums, it was about prisons, it was about colonialism and colonial famines. It was every injustice meted out onto the face of the earth, and it had to be got rid of in order for humanity to reach this next step, this borderless utopia where peasants lived like bourgeois and the bourgeoisie. And there would be skyscraper cities across Russia connected by airships. The theme of the air and of aviation is a very strong one in so the Soviet imagination. The aviator represents not only something that appears to be quite classless, but also the cutting edge of modernity. The aviator is a person who can explore, who can explore nature. Stalin was really seeing, and the culture of Stalinism sees nature as a kind of a dangerous obstacle and a thing that needs to be conquered. And obviously, Stalinism's hideous environmental crimes are a dark testament to that. So the Stalinists were not always on the same page as Stalin himself. Not that they particularly would have announced this or it would have been recognised. But the aspirations of grassroots Stalinists and of members of the Komsomol and junior members of the party was to work towards education and enlightenment. And education, just as with aviation, education occupies an important part of the Soviet mindset. It's extremely important to acquire it, which wasn't just about developing a career, but also it was part of an obligation owed to the party and to the state. Education and self-betterment were important kind of concepts about the development of kind of Homo Sovieticus, the new Soviet man. And the creation of this proletarian intellectual was one of the dreams of the revolution, that somehow by removing the chains of capitalist relations within society from the individual, that you would free the individual to reach their full potential. They would no longer have to work to pay rent or pay off debts or to pay for their surplus labour value to be extracted in terms of profits. Instead, all their energies would be theirs to maintain, and they would be able to then pour their energies into self-betterment. The good communist is the one who is constantly learning, constantly educating themselves. And in the 1920s and 30s, a network of party schools develops, where the next pool of party bureaucrats will be educated and selected from. The party member particularly had an obligation to self-betterment and to raise the level of their own culture as it was seen. This appears to have been a Bolshevik and later a Stalinist preoccupation, the idea of turning what the Bolsheviks as revolutionary intellectuals saw as a country of essentially backward peasants, Asiatic barbarians. Lenin had all sorts of appalling things to say about the peasants, and turn them into modern, educated, enlightened, cultured individuals. The actual symbolic destruction of the peasant as they left the land and came to towns and cities to become proletarians, the highest form of social grouping in the eyes of the Bolsheviks and the Stalinists, happened in terms of things like the policy of culturedness, or kulturnost, as it is seen in the Soviet Union. This policy of forcing the peasants to do things like shave off the traditional peasant beard, and wear modern proletarian clothes, get rid of the peasant smock and boots, and to do things like abstain from smoking, from swearing, from spitting, all these things that were synonymous with the backwardness of peasant life, because it wasn't simply just fussiness. It was a case of if peasant life was allowed to continue in the Soviet Union in the way that it had done, then peasant class relations would perpetuate themselves, and you would have really the kind of the infrastructure of feudalism and imperialism still there when you're trying to build a modern Soviet state. So you have to really, if you kill off the class enemies, and large numbers of kulaks are obviously killed off, the poor peasants, the proletarian peasants, are the ones who can be saved, rescued, given a bit of spit and polish, and turned into nice, attractive Soviet men and women. Now, we're going to return to this topic pretty soon and look at internal party discipline and the highs and lows of being able to access specialist party stores and restaurants and health clinics and all these lovely perks. But in the meantime, we're going to finish here. And if you can go and give us some praise or some description on iTunes, that would be great, much appreciated. You can also check out the Explaining History Facebook page. That's where I post other stuff and the odd video. Or you can check us out on YouTube. Whatever you do, remember to engage with Explaining History, say some nice things about it, pass on the word, and we'll keep growing. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.